Welcome to the joint meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison and the Madison Ethical Discussion Group. We have two speakers tonight. Midge asked Beth Wurzel to give us a brief review of the conference on spiritual activism in Washington, D.C. that both of them attended. And Midge also attended the earlier meeting in Berkeley, which Rabbi Lerner was also involved with. And if you have questions about that, she may be able to talk to you about that. This is the book that Rabbi Lerner has been promoting, The Left Hand of God, Taking Our Country Back from the Religious Right. First, we'll hear from Beth Wurzel. She's involved with the Ananda Marga Yoga Group, and she's one of the driving forces behind the local chapter. She's on the steering committee of the local chapter of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. Beth.
I was really delighted when Midge asked me to come and speak to all of you because I've come back from Washington with such a wonderful enthusiasm for the work that is going on under the name of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. And there are so many groups in our community doing such wonderful work. But for me, there was a real sense of homecoming coming into that conference because of its network, that it brought together people from all over and from so many different groups under one roof. And so I wanted to just go through a little bit. Midge asked me to just share a little bit of what went on at the conference. What was it that was so inspiring there? There were a number of things. Certainly the selection of speakers that were there. They crossed the spectrum. There were people from every faith community addressing issues across the spectrum of poverty and education and foreign policy and just every topic, but from the perspective of the spiritual values that the whole approach of the network is trying to promote, is looking at all of these various approaches to the environment, to politics, again, across the board, from the perspective of spiritual values. So the speakers were wonderful. We had one after another. It was almost overwhelming, but they were all excellent. We also had a chance, which was a nice feature of this conference, to actually do some action ourselves. We went up to Capitol Hill based on our particular geographic regions and had meetings that they had set up with our representatives. So our group got to go and meet with Tammy Baldwin, and we also got to go to Russ Feingold's office, although we didn't meet with him in person. It was great meeting with Tammy Baldwin. She admitted to us that she was working on her own list of values that she feels need to be underlying social policy. She shared with us her participation in the spiritual caucus up on Capitol Hill. It was all very encouraging. And we encouraged her to make her value statements public. We went to Russ Feingold's office. We didn't get to meet with him, but we did meet with one of his staff people who was a wonderful young woman. And clearly, when we first came in, she said, "Oh, you're here to talk about religion and politics." And we said, "Well, not quite." And we tried to explain the difference in where we were coming from. And slowly it dawned on her that this wasn't just the same old religion and politics. And by the end, I think she had a whole new look at a way to refresh her own enthusiasm and hope for what can happen in the political system. Because I suspect she had gotten somewhat jaded by her experience being up there for 3 years. So being out meeting with our representatives was a wonderful experience. We did get to break down into small groups and not only address different topics that were laid out by the conference, but also met just with our local folks, people from Minnesota and Wisconsin, just to talk about some of our experience at the conference, to give it that personal level of sharing, and to begin to network about what can we do when we come home. Some of the other kinds of workshops, a lot of the other kinds of workshops were focused on a document that I think Midge is going to speak more about later on, possibly, the Spiritual Covenant with America, which is the last half of Michael Lerner's book. And we studied up on the 8 points that were in this as a platform to present when we went up to our representatives. So each of these takes a different focus in terms of the responsibilities of a spiritually minded social activist, addressing issues of education or addressing issues of family values, addressing a foreign policy. He touches on the important areas in here and gives a spiritual perspective on those. What else did we do? Well, the other piece of it was looking at what do we do from here. You know, taking all the enthusiasm, it's wonderful to be in this group, the group we were in with 1,200 people, and be so inspired, but we were also looking at where do we go? How do we take what we've gained and bring it back into the communities? And some of what he clarified, which was really important for me, and I think was a step beyond what had happened at the conference in California, was really clarifying the purpose of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. Now, what is this organization about? What is the purpose of those of us who want to see certain kinds of changes, how can we focus our efforts? And he delineated basically three areas. One of them being the challenge of bringing back the misuse of the name of God. Taking back from the religious right the language of spirituality and religion and values so that they don't dominate the conversation. So that's one major focus. The other, looking to the other side of the political spectrum, was how to confront what he calls the religiophobia of the left. That I'm sure you've all seen the way that many people on the progressive left end of the political spectrum have a certain disdain for the language of spirituality and religion, taken a certain intellectual superiority. So he was also addressing what do we need to do to confront that attitude and be heard as spiritual progressives. And the final piece, which I think is really the core of his message, he delineated what he calls a new bottom line, that we've lived in this political system, in this social system now, dominated by the kinds of values that our capitalist economy has pretty much imposed on the way of life here, where the bottom line is self-interest, where the bottom line is me first, where the bottom line is what is in it for me. Economically, and then it translates beyond that. So if you have a social system where what he's saying is, we're all brought up in this, where you go to work and you're being presented with how am I going to benefit the bottom line of the company I work for? It's hard not to then over time take that mentality into how you approach other things in your life. So what the network is talking about is how do we confront that with a new bottom line? What is the alternative to allowing ourselves to continue to propagate a way of looking at ourselves and our lives that is reduced down to a certain kind of materialism? And so what he talked about and what inspired so many of us was this vision of a new bottom line. How do we instead make our social activist decisions? How do we make policy decisions in our country? How do we make economic decisions that have a bottom line of some of the core universal spiritual values that can then inform all of those decisions? And I think he has a nice way of describing those values that I'll just going to read off to you. He says, what if we made our decisions based on love and compassion, kindness and generosity, a response to all as the embodiment of the sacred, a response to the world with ecological sensitivity, and awe and wonder and gratitude at creation. So if we look at those, they're pretty hard to argue with. And yet, how much are they ever really looked at in terms of informing those everyday decisions and insisting that the ways in which our country is run address these values? So he's not saying we have to not pay attention to the bottom line, but he's saying we cannot exclusively, the old bottom line, but we can't exclusively be paying attention to that approach. We have to incorporate these values as well. So the work of the network then is to try and find ways to bring that approach into whatever area we address, into the environmental issues, into the issues of foreign policy, into issues of our economy and our tax system and everything you can think of. If you looked at all of them in terms of some of those values, what would be different? And as an action, as a process, we identified ourselves there in Washington as a movement in the sense of the civil rights movement, in the sense of the women's movement, that a movement is a grassroots rising up of people who have a common sense of what's needed and don't have to be all a part of the same faith community, don't have to be all part of the same political party, don't have to be all a part of the same social service and social action groups, but all identify with some of those same principles. So our work then is to do both consciousness raising, which is part of what happened in those movements of the past, as well as social action. And so the which comes down to what is the network doing here in Madison? You know, how are we trying to address some of those efforts to bring the new bottom line out into public discourse, to challenge the left and the right about where it places and how it discerns and uses the concept of universal spiritual values. So locally, we have now a reactivated local chapter that fell into dormancy after the California conference. And we've begun a process of creating some groups around some target activities. So currently, we have a group addressing how do we approach the business community about their bottom line and how to integrate spiritual values into their bottom line. So we have a group forming to do that. We have a group of us who are going to be trying to go out into some of the different spiritual faith-based communities to share some of these ideas. And we have a group doing a study group looking at how to examine the material that are out there and study and educate ourselves and help give opportunities for education to the public around some of these ideas. So those three have already been begun, and we've opened ourselves up, and thanks to our friend here, we have a website where we can now connect with people to keep everyone informed what the local group is doing. And so if you want that web address, you know where you'll find it. We have a membership list, an email list, if any of you wanted to receive emails of what's going on locally. You certainly can go to the spiritualprogressives.org website and see a lot of what is currently going on a national level with some of these ideas. And I really encourage people to pick up Michael Lerner's book and take a look at what he's saying in there, because I think it'll really speak to a lot of you when you read it. So enough of me, and let Midja take over and finish the discussion here.
Now, someone who needs no introduction. A longtime Madison activist, political activist, and social activist, Midge Miller.
Is it that I don't need it, or I don't deserve an introduction? Beth, thank you very much. I think she's really got the spirit of the meeting, and also she's been active, and you're on the board, aren't you, of this new group? And it seemed like a better division. I look at this whole spiritual progressive thing as being, let me give the analogy of the women's movement. There is the organizations, there was NOW, there was the Women's Political Caucus, there's the Feminist Majority and the different groups. But there were lots of people who never belonged to any of those, who either went into jobs that they wouldn't have gone into if the women's movement hadn't been there, or ran for office that they wouldn't have done it if somebody hasn't said, we can do it too. And so I was interested in talking to you a little bit more about it as a movement rather than as an organization, because I look at it that way. I have been increasingly concerned that the Christianity I see in the public square or on television or in the political dialogue, particularly of the religious right, is so very different from anything I read in the Bible, anything that I learned in my home or I learned in my church or I learned at Yale Divinity School. I don't understand how a person can claim the term of pro-life when the only thing they're for is fetuses, and they're quite willing to have the death penalty, they're quite willing to send our children off to war, they're quite willing to condone torture, anything that will, they have become sort of the foot soldiers for the religious right, for the religious people are becoming the foot soldiers for the neocons, and I just, it's so far from what I think of as any of the major religions. And so that has been bothering me for some time. And also the next thing that's been bothering me is how totally silent most of the mainline religions have been. As far as Christian, or it seems like the louder the religious right got, the quieter the mainline churches. I'm old enough to remember when the churches with leaders in the, well, I'm not old enough to remember the anti-slavery one, but I can certainly remember the civil rights. And I've just always been furious at it, because so when when I saw some signs that this church, which is a sleeping giant as far as I've been concerned, began to stir, I was attracted to this. And so the first thing I went to was a year ago in May, I went to Cleveland for another group that was started, which was called the National Clergy Network. And they had a very fascinating conference. It didn't work as quite as hard as Rabbi Lerner's, a hard taskmaster. He gets you there at 8:30 or 9 in the morning, and he keeps you there till 10:30 or 11 at night, 4 days in a row, well over 1,000 people both places. And so I then got interested in going to, and I went to the Berkeley conference, which at that time I understood to be sort of co-sponsored between Tikkun and Rabbi Lerner and Jim Wallace and the Sojourners. Now, it just happens that Sojourners is a little more evangelical than I'm comfortable with, but I thought it had an interesting balance. Rabbi Lerner's book is The Left Hand of God, and for those of you who may not have heard of it, Jim Wallace has a good one out on God's politics. So both of these groups, and much of what's happening now, is a reaction to what the religious right has been doing, but it's what we should have been doing all along. But for a while, it just, when they were starting, we were just backing off because we have this idea, we're nice, good, sweet people, and we don't talk about other religions. You know, we're not supposed to be anti-religious. But then I found all my secular friends were getting more and more anti-religious, you know, and they used to fairly tolerate me, you know, in the past. I could even mention I'd been a missionary and it didn't go against me much, but, anyway, he worked us pretty hard. But I'm making a big risk. I spent several $100s, more than I should have, buying some DVDs from that conference and also buying some CDs from the conference in Berkeley, which I could only find two of. And but I have brought most of them here, and I'm quite willing afterwards, if any of you will actually really make use of it by bringing it to your church for a meeting or having friends in around the house, and if you promise to get them back right away, I'm quite willing to have you borrow, because there's no point in my buying them and putting the money in them and leaving them in my own study when I don't even have time to look at them. So I'd be quite happy for you to do it. I also brought the book Kingdom Coming, which is called The Rise of Christian Nationalism in This Country. And I think that since I'm too old to read, I just buy these books for other people, you know. Anyway, I think there's other signs besides these conferences. There's probably many of them. You could name them too. The two I will mention, I've just noticed lately that Press House, which I used to be on the board over there, Press House, is actually setting up a dormitory for their people on the campus, which, you know, is almost shocking to, compared to the way we've been going lately. And of course, my favorite thing that's happening now is Bill Moyers and his series that started on Friday, which was it's on 8:30 Friday on Channel 11. It's called Faith and Reason. And the title is very essential because, as he says, faith and reason must go together. And why it takes a lecture to tell us that, but in many cases they seem to be enemies of one another. So I think that's very, very good thing. I will confess that I, in spite of my lifelong interest both in religion and politics, I am a high wall separationist. I think it is tremendously important to keep the institutional church and the institutes of government out of each other's pocket. The way I look at it is, it's like these are very strong forces, both religion and politics. And it's like if you had a wire to go to the electric lamp or something, as long as the wires are insulated and you have the two coming in, if they're well insulated, you have light and power that comes from the electricity. But if you rub off the insulation, you know what happens. You have a short circuit or maybe a fire or some fireworks or something. And I feel that this is something that is greatly being eroded now. Actually, we in, at least the rumor is, I don't know enough about Europe to know for sure if it's true, but that we in this country are more actively religious participants than they are in countries where you have a state church. They have a state church, so they let them take care of things, you know. But so I believe that the idea that we are setting up our school system so that it can fail, so we can have private schools, and we are now getting the things that the government should be doing for people, now the money being funneled through the churches, I think this is a very dangerous trend, because once an institutional church has the possibility of gaining from promoting one party or another, you begin to have both the church and the party being corrupted. So I think that, but I don't think that means that religion and politics do not belong together. I think it means that our personal faith and our actions, whether they're in our private life or our public life, should be whatever we do and whatever we think is formed by what we believe. And so, but it's just good to keep the institutions separately. We saw a little bit of this in the Catholic bishop that didn't want to give communion to a John Kerry or something, which is just a way of signaling he's not our boy. I think it's very scary at this stage, but we always act on what we believe, but we don't always believe what we think we believe. You know, it's a matter of what your basic beliefs are. But I think that many of the quite sincere Christians, I don't know much about how this works with the Jewish faith, but many sincere Christians in this country are being manipulated by a political base that has nothing in common with their real basic interests, but it keeps promising them abortion rights or prayer in the school or something like that. They purposely don't ever give it to them, because if they already had it, then they wouldn't have to go and work for it, you see. It's really quite a demonic, but quite a clever way of doing it. But they have manipulated these into a major political force in this country, which has given them a majority. It's a self-conscious thing. Reagan, who used to be pro-abortion in the old days, regardless of your views about it, he had a Southern strategy, and they didn't change the policy. They just kept promising these, and then the solid South, which when I grew up was a solid Democratic South. And of course, I was brought up with fried rats and stewed cats are good enough for Democrats and things like that. But I saw the light. Anyway, I think somebody might find that book about the kingdom coming interesting to do. The fundamentalists in the Christian church, in the Jewish and the Muslim religions are increasingly violent. And this is very dangerous, because as I see it, we are coming on hard times in this country. We are coming on hard times with our economy. We are coming with our environment. We are, we've been running on other people's credit card for a long time, but sooner or later there's going to be a time of, and we've managed to alienate most of our friends in the world. And I did my thesis in anthropology on my on the new religions in Japan after the war. After the war was a very traumatic thing for the Japanese, not just for the fact that they got the hell beaten out of them, but because their whole being, center of being, is that the emperor is divine, and so we made him announce that he wasn't. And this means that your faith, their faith in themselves was because they had always won. It's sort of like us, I guess. But anyway, this made it, in the immediate post-war period, these new religions were just multiplying all over the place. And every once in a while you get some feedback of some cult now. But as their society simmered down and stabilized out, those have become less and less important. But this is true around the world, and people under stress, if the rational responses they're used to don't work, they seek more and more irrational ones. So we are moving into a period which could very easily move into more cults and more extreme religions. And the problem is we have people who will strap bombs around themselves to destroy an enemy, and there was no reason they wouldn't also. If you're going to kill yourself, you might as well kill yourself with an atom bomb as any other kind, you know. I think we have a risk coming up here with this extremeness. And part of the problem that we as Americans have is that we are being consistently, by our own government, stripped of the tools that we have counted on to correct things when the government didn't seem to be going the right way. And I think this means that all of us are called upon to use both our faith and our reason and our best possible thinking and commitment, because we need to band together, and we cannot just have, you know, like a little bit of extra time if we want to help out something. We are really back to the wall at this stage, and we have much that we need to do to straighten this country out. One of the groups, the subgroup, I don't think Beth mentioned it, that I've been working, started to work with on the for the NSP group is we're working on trying to defeat this death penalty resolution that's going to be on the ballot. This was clearly put in at the last minute for the main purpose of getting their vote out. And we have an opportunity in this state to be the first state to defeat this, the first state in recent years to defeat this, and also the first state to defeat this anti-gay, anti-civil union amendment. So this is a major pressure for us, even those who don't really care much about party, to be sure that we send a message to the rest of the country. It isn't going to do you any good politically to bring those things in, because the people aren't with you anymore. And this is one of the few states where we have a chance of passing it. So the reason I'm mentioning this to you is that we now know of a couple things that we can do. And if anybody afterwards is interested in being on a small committee with me on that, to work on fighting the death penalty, there's a lot going on the marriage amendment, but most people don't even know the death penalty is coming up. And I know when I was in office, we always kept those bills in committee. We never had confidence that if you took it to the floor, to the polls, that it wouldn't pass. And particularly at a time of anxiety like this. So I'm glad you mentioned the covenant arrangements. And if anybody wants to come and talk to us about it afterwards, she has a copy, and I have a copy of our program, and you can peruse that. I won't try to talk all about it, but I think that I'd also like to talk about another thing about religion. We have another religion we don't talk about much. When we talk about Christianity and Judaism and Muslims or Islam, and but there's another major religion in this country that we don't use that name. Now, the Bible used to call it Mammon. that you cannot serve God and mammon? The way I translate that is greed and power. And those seem to be, are even those who are using the Christian foot soldiers, it is primarily their own profits and their own greed and their own desire for power that is driving this horse that we're in. And it, in many cases, it seems like in this country, markets and profits are more sacred than human lives. And that's why we're willing to send our children over to kill other people's children, because that's very profitable for the companies that do it, and it means that we can have more power over more people. And so I think we just have to consider that this is in many people's lives, you call it the bottom line, it is a form of religion. This is what, your religion is what you're dedicated to, what you really believe in. And so now that I've totally depressed you, I thought I would, I was quite fascinating. How many of you happened to hear Moyer's last, was very good, and I was... We'll pray for you. But I knew I had this talk coming around. I was wallowing around trying to think what it is, what to say. It's not enough to tell you the problem. What is the answer? And you may remember that when Moyers asked Salman Rushdie, what is the answer to these radical fundamentalist Muslims? He says they can only be brought down when regular Muslims refuse to be represented by the radical Muslims. And I think the same thing, it's only when the mainline Jewish churches and the mainline Christians refuse to be represented by the radicals in those two faiths. And it's very hard to do that if you don't express your own differences, if you don't define what your own beliefs are, if you don't say how you read the Bible. And they think that they are the only people with values. It's because we're sort of shy, we don't talk about it that way. But I think that there are, well, I don't know for sure, but I think there are millions of people out there who are basically sincere religious beliefs who, with some help in thinking through and thinking of the consequences of some of their thinking, can be moved into a camp that will make this a much more fair and just society. And I think we have to have be able to speak to the radicals and speak of our faith, even when those radicals are in very high places. Most religions teach love and justice and peace. Not only these, I guess we'd call them Eastern religions because that's where they came from, but also the Far East, in whether it's Buddhism or Hindu or any. Basically, the message of most religious leaders has been one of justice and peace and concern for all. And so I think we have to think in terms of the fact that faith and reason are our allies, but we need to add two more things. We need to add commitment and action. If you have a child that is running in the road and a car is coming, you don't discuss with him philosophically whether that's a good idea. You run in and get the kid out of the way. And I think this is what we have to do. We have to have enough commitment and enough sense that this is our responsibility as to what happens, that we will add to our faith and to our reason some commitment to action, and use our reasoning to find what action will be the best. So we invite you to the cause.
Now, discussion, questions for our speakers.
Lolita. Mitch, I just was wondering if you have worked with Arthur Thexton or know Arthur.
I know Arthur. Arthur was at the conference with us in D.C.
Okay.
And I called him the other day because I heard he's working on the death penalty.
He has for a long time.
And I got him. Yes. I got him in out in Oregon or someplace in the West. And he said he'd get back in touch with me.
Good.
He has a website which I haven't had time to look at, but I would be very much open to anybody who could spend some time on that issue. I've been out to talk to Scott Anderson from the Council of Churches, and Scott is hoping to
I'll tell you what we've got. When I brought in the nuclear weapons freeze referendum, I didn't have much time. And so I went out and just dropped it in John Fisher's lap, who was then the head of the Council of Churches. And I believe that we had the highest vote in the country on ours. And I believe that it was the churches that did it for us. So I went out to give Scott a pep talk, but he's already there in his thinking. He's trying to work on a mailing and things to go out. But he mentioned the fact that they would like to do these things, but this just was sprung on them. They don't have it in their budget or anything. And he wanted to know if I would help him raise money. I said, that's the thing I'm worst at. As the TMI, I never can get anything done there. But anyway, I think this is something that that we can do, and I just need some people to help me. And I do have this subgroup, but we need as many people as possible. And I don't think it means a lot of meetings, but I think we have some plans, and I'd be glad to work with it. And I will be in touch with Arthur when he gets back to town. Yes?
How would one go about connecting with you about the death penalty?
I have a phone number in the book.
And that's it?
Yeah, well, I can just talk to you. I don't want to take the whole crowd, yeah, because actually, this just came up this last weekend. I saw Scott on Friday. I tried to get him an afternoon call to solidify something, and I couldn't reach him, so I'm going to call him Monday. But I think we'll do something fairly soon. And I think the main thing is we want to help raise some money to help them get those out to every church in the whole state of Wisconsin. There has never been an organization where, you know, the church has a nest everywhere if it just wakes itself up. So give me your name before you go.
Okay.
The Texans group is called the Wisconsin Coalition Against the Death Penalty. Is that right, Delita?
I don't remember.
It has a website.
Yeah.
I think one word to describe the ethos of the Republican Party is mean-spirited, and it shows up in all sorts of ways. Well, death penalty, welfare, but most recently with respect to immigration. And I don't know, we don't have to agree about immigration policy, but the Republican House especially are simply mean-spirited. I think it's a potential alliance with people who aren't mean-spirited.
I was just thinking about a statement that one of my teachers, he described the situation we're facing in the world when someone said to him, well, the world is full of corruption. And he said, no, I don't agree. And they said, how can you not agree? He said, not the world's full of corruption. There's 10% of the people who function in that religion that Midge is describing, self-interest, immoral. There's 10%. And then there's 80% who need guidance and who will listen to them if they are the ones who are in power. There's another 10%. And who are they? They're us. They're the people who take a more ethical, moral perspective on things. And if we put ourselves out there, that 80% will listen.
At least some of them.
Yeah. Because they're looking for guidance. And the only people speaking to them are the other 10%.
David.
There's a very good article in the last Washington Spectator. Do you read that, Mitch? Rosa's addicted to
it. I used to take it. I don't think it's still coming in.
It is. Oh, to your
house. I mean, not to my house, it doesn't, but tell us what it says.
Mary, I forgot the author of that long article, but it's about the evangelical Christians being ignored by the right, by the left-wing political people. And anyway, he goes into a lot of detail about that, but points out that well over half of them, people calling themselves evangelical Christians are not far right.
Yeah, and I think that's a very movable group.
We need to contact, form coalitions with those people.
But what do we have to offer? We have to think that through.
Yeah, we have to be able to speak their language. And also he points out the fact that the humanist left wing sort of people who are, some of us are, have been ignoring religion entirely.
And well, so this is what was so meaningful, I think, about what Rushdie says, because basically he says it will be the mainline Muslims who will sort of deny letting them speak for them. And the problem is that for those religious people have had very few of another breed of Christian or Jewish, but I know the Christian world better, to speak for them. And if we speak for them, then the people have a choice. But if the only people that have enough nerve to speak are the people who are, you know, quite glad we have a good Christian president that's over killing all these people, you know, it's quite a different thing. But I don't think that the secular world can reach them. But I think that the religious people in that have a, what seems to be a more true biblical following of the religious leaders of all of them, have got to find their own mouth.
That's why I like the idea of humanism, and because we had long discussions about the value systems that humanists believe in, and they're real, and they're just as important as the value systems that the avowed Christians and all their, you know, various deist religions talk about.
This is why this group talks about the whole spiritual panoply. It isn't just these mainline churches and all, because there's a whole wide spectrum of people's beliefs and understanding.
There was one of the sponsors of the Washington Conference was the American Humanist Association.
There was another comment that Rushdie made that I thought was quite interesting, and that was that a sense of right and wrong is embedded in people through their through history, through living with each other and coming to some consensus, some rules. These may change and so on, but that religion then, but this has predated religions, and religions then articulate these things.
Yeah, it's deeper inside
us. I mean, answering, you know, the statement that well, how can you be moral if you do not believe in God?
I have a little niece that, I guess she's a grandniece, who even just as a little kid, that's not fair. She has a sort of funny way of saying it. And we all say to each other in the family, it's not fair. You know, we have an instinctive feeling about what's fair. It goes even deeper than whether that comes through our nature or whether it comes through our road religion or something, but we do have an instinctive feeling of what's wrong.
I think there's a wonderful little piece of research I read about 18-month-old children. They did this research somewhere in Europe, I think it may have been in Scandinavia, where they took 18-month-old children. They had them in a room with an adult who seemed to accidentally drop a marker on the floor. The 18-year-old children, universally, within 18-month-old, within 10 seconds, would go over and pick it up for that person when they didn't see them pick
it up. Isn't that interesting?
Altruism innate. They just would do it. And if they saw the adult was doing it on purpose, then they didn't pick it up. But if they looked like it was an accident and they had them reaching in a box, trying to reach something that they couldn't reach, and the children would automatically go over and help them. So if that isn't proof of what he was saying about there's something pre-religion that's just innate, I felt that was good research.
I happen to have a list of the speakers here, in case anybody does think they might like to see one of these groups or have it for your group. And you could look at this and see each of the tapes say who the speakers are. Almost every tape has three or four major speakers. And I think that whatever else you think about the conference, the quality of the speakers was just national treasure. It was, I must say, I don't have one of the DVDs because they didn't do them in Berkeley, of Bishop Spong, but Bishop Spong is gave such a fabulous speech out at Berkeley. He really knows how to craft a presentation. He's just in a class by himself. He was one of the early people. Remember, he wrote a long time ago, wrote that book, Rescuing the Bible from the Fundamentalists. And if you have any use for them, you know, I'll be glad to take them home, but they're not heavy. But if anybody would like to borrow them, I would trust you with them.
Concerned for their own well-being, they're not going to act so as to bring out, you know, the good for everyone, and they won't, you know, I mean, you got to wonder, you know, like, why would people accept our present government's behavior and, you know, do nothing, just do nothing? It's just so shocking to me. And, you know, I think that this is rooted in this desire or fear that if they change things, then they'll lose what they have. So I think, you know, there's this...
I think this is one of the keys to the problem. And I don't know how it was in the past, but I think now that we can honestly say if we do not solve these problems, we are guaranteed destruction. Because it's not anymore just, is it a nice thing to do or a good thing to do? If we do not, I don't know how many of you saw Gore's movie, but if we don't do something about the environment, the jig's up. If we don't do something about this, borrowing, our economy is heading for the tank. If we don't do something to stop this proliferation, he's breaking the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty as we speak. If we don't do something about that, I have a son that is the U.S. representative for the Mayors for Peace from Hiroshima. You know, we are on a cliff. This is no longer an optional thing to work on. But I think that part of it is they do not understand where their safety and where their fear should be coming from, because I have fears too. I have fears that they're not going to solve this problem, and that they're going to that we're going to go like lemmings right over the cliff.
Exactly.
It's the perverse use of language.
Yeah.
We cannot use the language that they are for to control
the language.
Yes, no, we have to use our own language and get that out. Well, George Lakoff's book,
mm-hmm.
something like, don't think of an elephant, is to the point. And I think we really have to take that seriously. But another, issue that I just read about today. I mean, every day you read about some other horror. But the federal, what do they call it, the FCC, wants to bring up again the idea that one entity can control all the television stations, all the newspapers, all the media in one market area. And this is one of the ways we've got to make, I mean, we fought them before, we have to fight them again, but this is critical, because so many people just absorb what's thrown at them, and if you've got one point of view only in a market, then part of the battle's lost.
This is why the Founding Fathers said that one of the most basic freedoms you must protect is the freedom of press. Now, they assumed if the press was free, it would do its duty. What we have is a free press, but it's free not to do its duty. And so we have them that are kowtowing to power, because first place, this is a very vindictive use of power that's going on, and second place, it butters their bread. And we have a major battle going on, and God bless people like Amy Goodman. You know, I think there's just a few people that just are out there every day helping us.
Alita.
I think nothing's going to happen if we can't have honest elections. And this country was founded in a way that was not by an election. I hope that it doesn't revert to people having to take the kind of action upon which the country was founded, which is a war. And so I think protecting our voting in this state is absolutely crucial. I also think that we cannot afford to divide ourselves between people who do and do not use spiritual language. And
yeah,
I have a concern
that's
about
right.
that. Those of us who do not use spiritual language, and I count myself in that. We know we are in a small minority. We know we need your group. Some people such as my mother, who've been reading about the rise of the religious right for the last 30 years, has been waiting and waiting and waiting for this to happen. I think that some of the antagonism on the part of people who call themselves agnostics, atheists, secular humanists, whatever, I think has been out of frustration.
Yeah.
And we ought not to be disdaining people who use their faith for the purposes of making this a better world. Nor should people who are ethical, secular people of whatever stripe be marginalized. We can't afford it.
I quite agree with you. They should not be marginalized. There is a point that this, and it is a very valid place, but there is a group of people in this country who, because of their own evangelical roots, are unlikely to respond to anything but about other religious talk.
That's something I'm keenly, cleanly aware of that.
Yeah.
That's why I say
I think that's
long overdue
point.
For this group.
I would certainly like to see people who take a secular approach a part of something like the network, because I don't see what we're doing as religious. I see, and I don't define spirituality as religion.
Exactly.
To me, spirituality just is talking about universal values. And so if we can't have that discussion be universal, then I don't know what this organization is about. So I think, I think everyone there in Washington would agree that secular is not a deterrent to spiritual, if you define spiritual in that universal way.
Incidentally, if you're interested in working on the voting question, I'm having a meeting at my apartment, 710 Meridor Heights, 1:30 Thursday.
Actually, my energies are going toward the gay rights amendment.
Well, but you see, if you don't have fair voting, what good is it going to do to get your vote?
You're throwing it back at me, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right.
I know you also will.
No, they're tied together.
Yes,
although I would change one thing you said. It's not whether it's in this state. I'm less worried about this state than I am the rest of the country.
Yeah.
This is probably as honest a state as we've got in the country. Maybe Oregon. But aside from that, I think... but it's a really scary thing. And if I had a regret of any sort, my regret is that I haven't done more on it sooner. But we have. The Institute had a whole big thing on it last spring. But even that was late. But we have been working with Kevin Kennedy, and we have done some things. We have a paper trail insisted on here. But they have used our tax money to buy machines that guarantee that we'll lose. And it makes me, I've got to clean up my language. How mad it makes me.
I'd like to bring up George Lakoff's stuff again. You know, of course, he's a linguist at Berkeley. When you're out at Berkeley, did you hear anything about those ideas? Because I'm so impressed by what he says in his book as being absolutely basic.
Oh, yeah.
Because what's happened is that the neocons and the people that are running this country now, the Bushites, are framing the arguments in their own terms, using, inventing all these legal. We have an example of this about a week ago when the term cut and run was used by about 30 or 40 different people all within a few hours.
Yes.
All the reporters and the news media and
they're good at it.
And it was an artificial invention by the Bushites for that particular purpose. But that's what they do.
See, well, and they're just better at it than we are. That's all there is to it.
He said they win all the time because the whole world then keeps on using that same language.
They have a lot of
what you have to do is
PR
never
stuff.
Say cut and run. Never use these catchphrases that are being used by the people who are not in control. Inventing their own catchphrases. you've got to beat them.
I think a lot of people are trying to do that, and it's not easy to do.
It's not easy. You have to be in far, well, yeah. Well, as Lakoff points out, he only learned that. He had a PhD in linguistics before he even knew this was an important issue.
Yeah.
He got into it, I've forgotten exactly how, some sort of a practical aspect. He was writing a book or something, investigating something, and he had to realize incrementally that this is really important. The deeper he got into it, he realized it was central.
Right.
And so it's not simple. It's not easy. I think we all need workshops on this subject. And we get experts in the subject to teach us, or at least do some.
Yeah, well, I think this is something we're all struggling with and trying to do it, and we just realize how hard it is.
Well, I think the Democrats really need to get off.
Well, don't say they, say we.
Learn how to do that.
Don't say they, say we.
I said the Democrats. Well, okay. We,
no, don't
we
say
do.
They, we.
We,
yeah.
Okay.
We progressives.
We have to get it. Well, he also points out, you know, the Republicans have funded, you know, billions of dollars when you had it all up to fund these think tanks.
Yeah.
And the think tanks that come out with all
the
these
language.
All this language. And our side, the liberal side of the political spectrum, has
and we're not so willing to manipulate people either, which is, you know, actually I used to say that the better a group sounds, the more worried I am about them, because particularly I remember during the women's movement, they had all these, you know, motherhood and apple pie, but the better it sounds, the more suspicious I am, because, or it's like this new legislation, Clear Skies, you know.
Well,
they don't mind not having any touch with reality. Their purpose is to mislead. And the reason they don't look guilty when they lie, like you and I look guilty, because they think they have the right to do that. They think they are of a group to decide, and that the rest of us, you know, have to be fed whatever it is to keeps us coming along. And I think that I remember one reason I founded the Madison Institute. I was back
liberal,
in
a liberal think tank.
It's a liberal think tank. I had founded a group in Washington called Interchange Resource Center in the 70s, warning people about the far right coming. And we were for a number of years. Interesting thing. We for a number of years afterwards. I hadn't thought I could do anything but have a conference, but there was so much interest. We hired a little half-time staff person, and she had a free space in Rabbi Saperstein's something of Hebrew congregations, I don't remember the exact title. And one time when I was in Washington visiting, Rabbi Saperstein says, Mitch, I'm having some trouble with my conservative rabbis. And I said, well, what's the problem? He says, they don't like you picking on the religious right. And I said, well, why is that? He says, because they're Zionist. And I says, do they know why they're Zionist? I says, do they know that they believe that the Armageddon is coming, and that there's going to be a battle, and the horses are going to be up to blood up to their knees, and that all the Jews are going to be killed except a certain thousand that are going to become Christian? Is that what they want? He says, they don't care why. They don't care why they're against it. They are helping them now, and so they'll deal with that later. They don't think it's going to happen that way. And this is what happened. I know at the conference we had out in Berkeley, one of the best speakers was Jim Garrison, and that's not the right name. I've got that cross-filed in my head. Anyway, he was explaining how the religious right, the extreme Zionist Jews, and the military-industrial complex are locked into a troika, where they have no affection, no respect, nothing for each other, but they are locked into the same policy. This guarantees a continued war for the military-industrial complex. The Jewish people hope it saves Israel, and the Christians think it's going to bring Armageddon. And this is a very, these are deeply held beliefs, and this is a very hard thing. This is a very hard thing for rational people to deal with, you know. But it's quite true that. They have the resources. I founded the Institute, and we've done lots of good things in Madison, but we're about minus about
$4 billion compared to what, because, you know, they have, and, well, that's enough.
Get on the phone to Bill Gates.
Yeah, I should get on the phone to Bill Gates. Well, Roger Buffett, I mean, not Roger Buffett, the
Warren
Buffett, I just understood he's going to give away some money. We had people, during the McCarthy campaign in Nebraska, we had people sleeping on his floor. I should get in touch with him, yeah. Yeah.
And where's George Soros when we need him?
Well, he tried to warn us. He tried to warn us. He says if you re-elect him in 2004, the world will never trust you again, and that's exactly where we are.
Do you have anything coming up from the Madison Institute that you want to mention?
Well, we just sort of spun out our thing. We're working on a progressive agenda thing, but it's we haven't made our fall program. And I'm not spending much time with them because they can't do political things. And I do tell you, there's a wonderful party going to be at Ed Garvey's house. Are we allowed to talk about this in church? at Ed Garvey's house from 5 to 7 Tuesday night for Nancy Nussbaum, who is running against John Gard. Well, she's running in the primary and then against John Gard up in the 8th District. This is, there are only 10 or 12 open congressional seats in contestable districts in the entire country. And we have one of them, and we have three good candidates, but Nancy has the best chance of winning, and she'll be just what you'd like. And you should be sure to come, and if you don't, you can send money. I've got some stuff in my flyer in case anybody happens to come up and ask me about it later. I just thought I'd have it with me.
More questions?
Yeah. I just want to get first a quick little comment about the conundrum that comes up when we talk about the we and the they, and the difficulty of getting past that to understand that, you know, like kind of we're all in the same boat here. And I don't know how we can move past that. It's very difficult. But the other thing was something that came up before when we were talking about the schools and how they made sure the schools were really bad so that
yeah.
They have private schools. And I think it has to do with teaching children to think. And I don't really know what we can do about that, but I think that is kind of like a base problem that we have, is that people just don't know how to think. They don't know how to step back and say, wait a minute, something's wrong here.
Yeah, it's a hard nut to.
Yeah, as a former university teacher, I taught in Whitewater for 30 years or so. It was so obvious, the incoming freshmen especially, just horrible.
Well,
it's terrifying.
These tests,
memorization, that's all they need.
Exactly.
These tests, they're teaching to the test,
exactly.
Is just putting robots to go into the factories for the at low wages for the factories. And
the mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just want to say to you, we are up against the wall. We do not have the luxury of just living our lives the way we've always done it. That's my personal feeling. And I think one thing that stops people is, A, they don't think it'll do any good, and B, they don't really know what to do. Now, I don't know either of those things, but I have one little thing I'd like to leave you with. When we were home on furlough, my husband was speaking around a lot, and he used to tell a story about some people in the Coast Guard out in the California coast. And there was a big storm out in the Pacific, and they were listening to the radio and all this. And first, all of a sudden, there came an SOS from some ship out there, and one of the guys got up and started putting his yellow slicker on. And his buddy says, "Hey, man, don't go out there. You'll never come back." He says, "I have to go out. I don't have to come back." The way I look at it is we have to try. We don't have to succeed. We don't have to make up our mind that if we try, it'll work. We just have to find the best thing we can do and work on it. And at least we can live with ourselves even if it doesn't work.
Jim, you
have a question. Oh, I just want to say, I was kind of afraid that the green God and the power and the greed that kind of goes with religion. So I've seen so much, and I see that a lot with, I think people my age, at least ones I've come in contact with a lot, is that they're always chasing the green God.
I don't quite understand that. Explain it to me a little better.
The green God. Basically, they're looking for the bottom line, what's going to, you know, give me versus the common good for everyone, and make me money kind of a thing.
But they have to have a very short-term view of what's in their in their own self-interest now, because when the boat goes down, you go down with it.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then along with the electoral thing, I just want to mention, I saw that the flyer out at the library that the UW system is having a open or free forum on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and I missed the last, I think it started last week, but I think it's maybe more so to educate people and better understand our electoral system.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought I'd mention it.
I think we've worn everybody out.
As we wind up, can I ask one last question? Is there any highlight from the Washington conference that you'd like to leave us with? Any favorite speaker?
Jeez.
Well, I guess one of my favorites was Jim Wallace, who's the evangelical minister. He gave an example of going to I loved the story. He said, I went through the Bible, and I found something like 2,000 references to poverty. So I went to a conference of all my fellow evangelical ministers, and I confronted them. And I said, look, there are 2,000 references here. How can you keep ignoring this? This is in the Bible. And finally, he wore them down, and they finally agreed with him, you're right. Poverty, the issues of poverty, they really are there. We really aren't doing what we need to be doing. But go tell our PR people, because we have to do what they tell us. So that was the story he left us with.
That's who we are.
Who are the PR
people?
They
have a department.
Yeah, in the church. Within the church.
They're chosen by the...
Who decide how to present
our PR. That's the problem, isn't it? And we put... I'm very pleased to see that Republicans are splintering a bit, and that's a good thing, because mostly they have spoken with one voice, the bad voice.
There's lots of Republicans have been getting increasingly worried. I just think the biggest argument we have is that your own personal self-interest is at stake. And I happen to have 19 grandchildren, and I think every one of them is inheriting already a several thousand dollar debt. And the great-grandchildren will come in with that much debt, you know. And, you know, they call us tax and spend Democrats. You know, every time they get in office, they run
spend.
And, you know, a lot of people are mad at Jim Doyle because he didn't do everything. If you come in and they've already spent you into a hole, and you have a legislature that won't let you do anything, the best you can do is say no occasionally.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is, the tax and borrow is a much more dangerous thing. Any of these countries, like China or Japan or any of them, that stop buying our dollars, and we've had it. You know, it was one of the biggest things we have against both Venezuela and Saddam Hussein, who was one of our boys. You know, he was long-term our sponsor, just like Noriega was. One of the biggest things is he was going to sell his oil in euros. And that undercuts our economic system. We are on a skidding planet. You know, we are... You can't just go home and live your life the way you used to. And that wears you out, doesn't it? But at least it gives you something worth doing.
I'd like to tag in onto what she has just said in terms of the concern that's rising pretty high, I think, among a number of conservatives within the old conservatives,
yeah,
or the
modern
conservatives are scared to death, and which is a segue into our meeting on the 23rd
of July,
and I'm going to be giving a presentation on a humanist view of Kevin Phillips' book American Theocracy, which is much more than theocracy. He gets into the issues of the national debt. He gets into the issues of the oil industry. And Kevin Phillips is a person who I don't want to take a lot of time, but he's in a great part responsible for the mess we're in.
He was our nemesis for years,
absolutely.
And now he's our hero.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And he has done a turnaround. If he can do a turnaround. it's very interesting material, and interesting to see how scared some of the former really hardcore conservatives are.
What's the date book? Place?
What?
The date?
Oh, Bob.
It'll be here at the Prairie noon on Sunday the 23rd of July. And of course, the ethical discussion group is invited. If they are looking for a July program. Rose.
You know, another scary thing that Bush is trying to do is get the line item veto.
Uh-oh.
Now what he wants to do is just eliminate any social program that's government funded. And just give it all to...
He acts like he's given up on the Social Security thing. He slipped it into two different bills so far, and they've caught him so far. Sooner or later, he'll get it when nobody's looking.
We're looking. Carefully. A lot of people are looking.
Yeah.
How many people have read the book Collapse? I'm trying to remember the author.
Jared Diamond.
What's his name?
Collapse.
Jared Diamond.
Jared. J-E-R-E-D. Diamond. Collapse. It's about how societies either succeed or fail. And, two good examples fairly close to us are Haiti and the Dominican Republic on the same island. Oh, Haiti is a total basket case forever. Yeah. The Dominican Republic is still okay. And they're right on the same island. But anyway, my point is that it's really critical that we get it right. And politics is only incidental. Yeah, but we have to pair politics right. We have to make, as a society, to make the right decisions. They're really as important.
I'd like to talk to this table of young people over there. I remember I was speaking to a West High group one day. Anyway, I was speaking to this high school group, and I said,
"All relative."
And I said to them, I said, "Well, I'm going to get out of here alive," which meant I'm so old I'll die before it happens. And I considered that getting out alive. But it's the younger people that I'm most concerned about because, you know, I could probably skid through. I'm 84. And, you know, the collapse may not come while I'm here. But I do have those 19 grandchildren that I have to think about. And anyway, it's in your court now. We've blown it for you.
Remember, Mitch has these DVDs if you want to see them, and that's good.
I really would be willing. I spent several hundred dollars on those, and I would be glad to share.
Thank you.